Good afternoon. So I was asked to speak a little bit as to an assessment concepts, what work and what doesn't, rather than, and I'm going to let Tina speak more on the measurement side and those types of things. I'll just share with you some of my experiences having been involved with various organizations in terms of developing assessments and standards. The path that we seem to be going down here with the commodity groups and codes of practice is going to be a difficult one. Commodity groups are large, they're unwieldy, they're difficult to regulate in any type of way, whereas individual companies seem to be able to make much quicker decisions and move things forward. So I don't think that it's not a criticism, it's not a statement that things can't be done, it's just that it's going to be a very long road, and it's going to take a great deal of work to do those things. So in terms of what really I've seen work in other organizations is that there needs to be leadership from major players within the industry. Other individuals within your industries are going to be looking to seeing what the leadership's doing. If the leadership's there, participating in the program, being an example, it actually moves things forward quite a bit. I think linking things like animal welfare assessments with other programs that producers are already comfortable with pays off some benefits as well. There's no question that if there's a way to find financial incentives, I've seen that work with things like Maple Leaf Ducks with McDonald's and their egg producers, but financial incentives are not just necessarily premiums on your check. It can also be improvements in efficiencies. There needs to be recognition among the leadership of the organizations that it is a show-me world, not just a simple trust-me world, and that they really need to get behind the program and understand that the providing the data is extremely important. I think one of the other things that has worked is broadening things from animal welfare assessments alone to working with Maple Leaf Ducks. We created a stewardship assessment program which involved animal welfare, it involved biosecurity, and it involved the environment. All those things were assessed when people went onto farms with an auditing team, and it created great benefits for both the producer and for the company itself. Much fewer issues around things like biosecurity, much fewer complaints about environmental issues. The application of an assessment program was taken on by the duck company because they thought it was going to be required by their retailers. Turns out that it wasn't. Turns out the retailers were really happy just knowing they were doing something. They've kept investing in the program, training people, taking on all kinds of things. And I've asked them, why are they still doing it if it's not required by retailers anymore? The answer, they said, is simple economics. More attention to detail, more attention to the animal welfare issues on the farm, animal care, less issues coming into the plant. At the end of the day, the company's making more money, the producers are making more money because people are paying much more attention to detail. And if they need to verify and demonstrate that they have a program in place, they have the data to do so. Things that don't work. I think things that don't work include waiting too long. Waiting too long is a problem because I think someone else may fill that void, one. And number two, the farmer all of a sudden appears forced into demonstrating that they care about their animals rather than debunking that myth. Other things that don't work, just really basic things in terms of trying to measure everything, having an extremely heavy, paper-heavy program in place, and we really do need to make programs which are feasible, affordable, and also credible. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Ed. Okay. I've been charged with speaking about the metrics or the different sorts of recordings or measurements that we make for animal care assessments or animal welfare assessments. And so first we've been asked to talk about advancements and then talk a little bit about roadblocks. And, you know, in the last 40 years, we've gotten much better at organizing our thoughts about how to measure animal welfare. And it's only been about the last 10 years we've been getting very organized in our thoughts about how to monitor animal welfare on farms and the different types of measurements that we use. We've done quite a bit of advancement in thinking about finding the best measures that are both conceptually and statistically objective and meaningful. So how can a person go onto a farm and come up with a metric that reflects how well the animals are taken care of and how well the animals are feeling? So there's three kind of basic concepts that we have to think about. And one is, I'm going to say, finding the right measures in terms of how valid they are in reflecting the welfare of the animals. Secondly, finding the good measures, and by good I mean with regard to sort of the statistical or measurement property of those measures. And finally, finding the practical measures. Those are feasible that can actually be applied in an animal welfare assessment. So in finding the right measures, those that are valid, they have to actually reflect animal welfare. We talked about, and so a number of our speakers talked about, resource-based measures, design or input-based measures like space allowance, cubicle design. These are good, repeatable, reliable, to some degree, measures, okay? But the disadvantage is they don't reflect necessarily the welfare of the animal. Then we have our animal-based or outcome measures, which are like mortality or disease. But these are the ones that are more difficult to do measurements in. And this is what really leads me into thinking about what a good measurement is. Okay, so let's take, for example, a concept of welfare like nutrition, hunger, freedom from hunger, nutritional status. We all pretty much agree that's an important, pretty important aspect of the welfare of an animal. If we were to take a resource-based measure, we might look at the feeding system that the animal is on, how much it's fed. It doesn't necessarily tell us what state the animal is in. So one of the common ways that we use is, say, body condition score, or we could use a body mass index or the weight of the animal or something like that. So we've got a body condition score. It's used generally across the board. But how good of a measure is it with, first of all, how accurate is it with telling us the nutritional state of the animal? And people have been working on this. Anna Johnson has done, with a large group, I think probably for PQA, has done work on looking at if you look at different body condition scoring systems, how well they match up with back fat amount in pigs or in sows. And secondly, how good is the inter-observer reliability in these sorts of measurements? So you have 10 people trained to a body condition score. They go and look at one animal. They better come up with the same answer because that means your measure is a good one in terms of inter-observer reliability. And another point with that is how much training does it take to get those people to have good inter-observer reliability. And there's a lot of research doing a lot of what Anne-Marie talked about is looking at this, their programs, and so we've come a long way with that. And how long it takes to train also affects then the feasibility of using it. Okay, so for roadblocks, how much time do I have?
3 minutes.
3 minutes? Okay, I'm good. All right. For roadblocks, we haven't been taking the measurements. I've heard that time and time again today, we don't have the numbers yet. Some of it is we're just developing the metrics, forgetting those numbers, or if we have the numbers, we haven't been sharing them. And I can understand and appreciate there's a lot of reasons for that. Some of it is the lack of time, lack of an infrastructure to gather that data and put it into a database. Lack of the measurements, the appropriate ones, but some things like mortality and disease, we should have those, but we haven't been looking after them. Another reason for not having the numbers is confidentiality, and I can appreciate that. Fear of the information being used not in a positive way, and I think everybody has that concern. But in some cases, I think knowing the numbers will tell the good story as opposed to a bad one. And my example comes from pig transport work that I've been involved in for a number of years. Like Catherine had said yesterday, we don't even know a lot of numbers, and we have these ideas in our head about what's going on, but we don't have the numbers. I was involved in a project where we were able to get all of the data from Ontario pork for an entire year, all 4.5 million pigs that were marketed in a year, the in-transit loss or dead loss amounts. Okay, so we have in our heads that transport, yes, it is a very stressful time, but how many animals actually died in transport in that year? It was 18 out of 10,000, which is 0.018%, which is a pretty good statistic when you think about it. It's better than many of us would have thought. So even though the numbers might be a roadblock right now, they might be a good way forward. Thank you.
It's a bit like being at the Toronto International Film Festival. I'm just waiting for Brad to come in and he can answer a few questions. So I'm just going to talk, and I think Tina took some of my minutes, but anyway, I'm going to talk about assuring the basics of animal care, and there's been lots of conversation about that. I mean, Ed talked this morning about the importance of benchmarking and using those numbers and those figures, and certainly with OMAFRA, we've been collecting data, a lot of it postmortem data, but we've been collecting data and not really been using that. So I know in the last couple of years we've hired summer students to kind of put that information together to collect the data and to do some analysis on it. And Jeff Ertin also talked about, you know, regulations, that regulations up to a point that they can certainly ensure the basics of animal care. But I was at a food safety meeting in 2007, and there was someone there from the EU that was talking about the plethora. Someone else used that word, so I thought I'd use it. The plethora of animal welfare regulations in the EU, but he said that you know, really they have lots of regulations, but really what the regulations did was prohibit or limit the cruelty. They hadn't really been able to improve the animal welfare, and he said that really what they were going to kind of shift things in the EU and focus more on education, and that's what Jackie talked about yesterday, about, you know, ensuring basics of animal welfare through education, and that would be, you know, educating everyone, educating the enforcement. So I've done a lot of work in the last few years with our meat hygiene officers that work in the plants, and there's a contingent of those people here today, which is very, very positive. Also working with our veterinarians on different aspects of humane transport and humane slaughter, and also working with, I think Jeff Russian was talking about the auditors, and we've had several professional animal auditor certification workshops. We had one here in Ontario, and we had one that they organized out in Alberta to try and to build up that infrastructure of animal welfare auditors in Canada using Canadian standards. And we're also currently trying to push through an animal auditor certification course for the poultry industry, because that's another area that we don't have training. It's not available. And a few months ago, I had three people call me from one province where the CFIA is withdrawing their meat inspection, and they're going to be writing provincial meat inspection regulations. And they said, well, you know, what's the most important regulation? And I said, the most important regulation to me, you know, when I started this job, I'm the Humane Standards Officer, and when I started in 2006, I thought I'd just be driving around in my little hybrid car, going to all the plants and fixing all the problems. But, you know, after about 2 years of that, I thought, well, you know, it's not going to work this way. Everyone needs to be trained. The people that are doing the enforcement, the people working in the plants, and the people that are transporting the animals. So that's really, I kind of shift focus, saved a lot on gas, and really concentrating on education. So when they phoned me from this particular province and said, what's the most important regulation? I said, it needs to be that everyone has training and certification. And really, that's our big barrier, is access to that education. So if you want to learn about humane slaughter, or, you know, that oxymoron, but I don't really think it's an oxymoron. But if you want to learn about humane slaughter, you have to spend time and go on the internet and, you know, look at Temple Grandin's website or the Humane Slaughter Association website in the UK. There's really not a lot of information. There's no courses available. So it's really for a barrier for ensuring basic animal care. It's really the, you know, the lack of resources, and then for producers, it would be the lack of time, because, I mean, there's, you know, they have every, you know, they hate getting another binder in the mail, another program. They don't have time. This year we've had in Ontario, we've had issues around lack of rain and then too much rain. You know, to spend a day and do some training is very difficult. So I have looked at some of the other models that they have for training, and I know Anne-Marie talked about it this morning, and I think it's in Denmark where they develop these things they call stable schools, and I think it means farm schools, because I think they call barn stables, but they have these stable schools, and it's like 30 different producers, and they form this kind of collective, and in order to be in that collective, you have to agree to let everybody else come on your farm, do a tour of the farm, and then they sit down and go, well, you did this right, and you do that you know, you did that wrong and that kind of thing. And they use their some of the regulations and some of the animal care assessments. So I really think that's maybe a model that when we go down the road with the animal care assessments, instead of maybe just sending the producers a binder, that we try to find out some more interesting ways of offering them this education. It's your turn.
Thanks, Penny. In my substantive job, what I do is animal welfare enforcement. I do a different thing than the codes of practice. The codes of practice and the quality assurance programs are all about encouraging people to do a better job. A lot of the culture of animal welfare concern from the public is about catching the bad guys and punishing them. It's about vengeance. And so to a large section of the population, they don't care about you doing a good job because they don't perceive that to be animal welfare. And that's because we have over 100 years sort of history of only doing animal welfare enforcement in companion animals. That many, like all the U.S., or many of the, up till 5 years ago, many of the U.S. states and most of the Canadian regulations exempt normal farm animal practices from regulatory enforcement. We don't have any regulatory enforcement. By definition, you can't do anything evil to a cow because if everybody else does it, then it's okay. But what the public is perceiving is that there are things that we do to livestock that just may not be acceptable, or certainly aren't acceptable to certain levels of the country, or certain parts of our society. And we live in a multicultural society. So one of the big problems I perceive for the near future is how do we deal with enforcement? How do we deal with the really bad guys or really bad behavior? How do we deal with the need to discourage bad behavior? We've already, the codes of practice deal with the encouraging good behavior, but there is a certain amount of bad behavior that has to be eliminated and discouraged. And we don't have a culture, we don't have a policing culture, we don't have a judge, prosecutor, enforcement culture of doing that. And often people who are concerned with the welfare of animals are outraged when somebody starves 500 cows to death and gets a $50 fine. They see that response as disproportionate, as not representative of Canadian society. So the part that I'm sort of interested in and that I'm most interested in monitoring for the next 20 years is how do we develop a enforcement culture in farm animals? And if we've learned anything from our human equivalents, is that enforcement by military standards doesn't really work. We enforce laws on people by community policing, which means most of the time police are embedded in the community to which they serve, and they monitor the community in which they serve, and they try to correct problems, try to avoid individuals getting into a criminal method of behavior. I think that's one question that it's not part of this meeting. This meeting was all about encouraging good behavior. But I think it's a valid sort of cultural question, is how do we deal with outrageous behavior by people who portray themselves as farmers? So that's what I'm sort of interested in, and maybe that's why I'm here. I don't know. We know. It's good. Yeah.
Okay, good afternoon, folks. Thanks for inviting me here. I really support the NFAC process. And my talk today, I'm just going to talk a little bit about, to put our industry in perspective, I'm going to talk about the evolution of animal care. And I'm going to speak about beef cattle, because that's what I know. And like a James Mitchell novel, I got to start at the beginning. Cattle ranching began in Western Canada in about 1874. The American West was already overgrazed, and some cattlemen began looking north. You know, there was vast seas of grass, and it had rested since the buffalo had been eradicated a few years prior. Anyway, ranch management in those days involved populating the range and harvesting the survivors, basically. There was absolutely no animal care. There was very little shelter. The prairie fires had taken the trees. And anyway, that's where we began. Fortunately, it coincided with a period of global warming. Contrary to our belief, history didn't start in 1970. If you go back to 1870, there was a period from 1874 until 1906 where there was only one bad winter that really killed a lot of cattle and stuff. So that was in their business plan that they just populated the range. Anyway, this all came crashing down in the winter of 06. It was, this 1906 was a very, cold, harsh winter. And the people that, the gentleman ranchers that hadn't put up any hay or hadn't done anything, they lost most of their herd. The investors, there'd been a real attraction to ranching because it was so easy and profitable. The investors fled the industry, and then we moved into a new era. There was a small farm, the settlement, of the prairies was quarter section, half section farmers, and they raised a few cows. There was no supply management in those days. Everybody was allowed to milk their cow and sell their cream if they wanted to, and most chose to. And so the cattle were milked, the cows were milked, and the calves were fed to skim and stuff. But life was pretty good for cows. And the big southern outfits that I talked about earlier, they'd learned their lesson. They'd introduced more hardy breeds. The first, neglected to say, the first cattle that were on the prairies were thin-skinned southern U.S. type cattle. And but they brought in genetics from Ontario, British breeds, and from the British Isles. Anyway, this was a big improvement. And this lifestyle continued right through till the 60s, pretty much. We were self-sufficient in beef. We weren't exporting, but when I talk about some setbacks, the one setback was the transportation at the time. Most of the grain left the prairies because of the ridiculously low subsidized freight rate. All the grain came to Ontario, and the young cattle all followed. And the train ride took a week, or basically they tried to offload them and feed them, but there was a lot of problems with transportation. But compare that to today, with our smooth highways and our tractor trailers with air ride suspension. These cattle are from the ranch to the feedlot, or sometimes staged through another farm in a matter of hours. And so anyway, that was some of the problems we had in the early days. And then I think we had a sort of major setback of animal welfare in the 70s and 80s. Grain prices were chronically low, and we ended up with a great expansion of the beef herd, with many producers raising cattle who had little experience. The emphasis was on beef production per unit, weight per day of age, weaning weights, rate of gain, and many farmers calved their cows in the winter months to try to get a few more pounds to sell in the fall. Frame size of the Canadian beef herd grew just increased rapidly with the introduction of continental European breeds. And little attention was paid to welfare issues like acceptable birth weights, calving ease, and suitability to Western Canadian conditions. Veterinarians did a roaring business, pulling calves and performing C-sections. And if calves survived parturition, they had, problems with cows with big udders and hard to nurse. But, when you talk about improvement, this is a period that I can remember as when I was a young producer. The 20 years is just, or 25 years since has been remarkable improvement. We're back to a more moderate-sized cow. Calving ease data on sires has resulted in vets being used mostly for consultants, nutrition experts, and for vaccination protocols. You know, we'll go years without a C-section now. Cattlemen who left the business in the 80s have trouble understanding how my brother and I, for instance, can calve out 800 cows with, very little problem. But, ranchers have addressed. Handling facilities have improved. Better understanding of animal behavior, thanks to people like Dr. Pager and Temple Grandin. Things like flight zones, we incorporate the understanding of an animal's flight zone into the handling facilities. And today's solid-sided holding pens, curved alleys, things like that. It keeps the cattle moving calmly. Gone are the whips and the overuse of prods we heard about earlier today. Even in the large 20 to 30,000 head feedlots you hear about today, a pen size is usually 100 to 200 head. And that is what Temple Grandin says cattle prefer if given the choice. Cattle are all herd animals, and she's observed that small groups of cattle experience more stress than a 100 or 200 head. Some other things we've done. Flying across Canada, I noticed all the thousands of straw bales put up. There's little feed value in straw. Cereal straw is baled largely to provide comfort for livestock and even some enjoyment. There's nothing cattle like better than when you bed them in the winter. Yeah. Most of us raising cattle today are good at it. I'm proud of the ethics of the cattlemen. The tough economic times has weeded out the bad ones. And the cattle producers of today understand that good animal care is important for sustainability. Acceptance of the code of practice and that acceptance and compliance will be partially market-driven, and that will only help things. So in closing, next time you experience a week of miserable weather, especially if it's a wet spring snowstorm, and you're bothered that your commute might take a half hour longer and you have to shovel the sidewalk, think about our Canadian cattlemen, women, and probably their kids. They're out in the night providing feed, shelter, bedding, and assisting new calves if they need it. Thank you. We care.
Thank you, Susan. Dave, congratulations on putting our feet on the ground. But, Dr. Whiting, I'm Bill DeBar from the Horse Welfare Alliance of Canada, by the way. Terry, you blew it. Your subject was conflicts in culture, or cultural conflicts, or something like that. We have a lot of livestock, as you suggested, that is not cared for properly. And one of the big ones, I'm ashamed to say, is the horses. And I think our culture needs to support the livestock industry by reporting observations of untended or distressed livestock, whatever the species. And I think this is one of the things that our culture needs to do is take... we don't have to report them to the RCMP. We should report them to somebody in each province that has been designated.
Ask the question.
In Alberta, thank you very much, Susan. In Alberta, it's the alert line. So what recommendations have you got with respect to that, Terry?
In Manitoba, there is no SPCA. And we have a toll-free number for reporting to my office, 724, and we cover it on the weekends. And in Manitoba, concerns about animal welfare are reported to the Office of the Chief Veterinarian, who I work for. And honest to God, I don't perceive we have a problem with non-reporting. We have of our reports, we have about 15% of them are substantiated. So we get about 5 false positives for every true animal concern that's out there. So I disagree. I don't think there's any hesitation for people to call enforcement if they believe there's a problem.
Question also for Terry. I mean, we hear mixed messages from the industry about how they view animal welfare regulations. Some seem to think it's the worst thing in the world. Others think it would level the playing field. I mean, Manitoba seems to be give more legal force to the codes of practice than other provinces. And I was wondering if you have any sense of how producers would respond to codes being given more legal force throughout the whole country.
In Manitoba, the codes are fully enforceable. I had, just last year, I had a swine producer starve 2,000 pigs to death. And in the 93 Code of Practice for Swine, there's a line in there that says farmers should report high mortalities to veterinarians. So I wrote a charge saying Mr. X on this day did not report a large mortality loss to a veterinarian in contravention of chapter paragraph this of the Code of Practice for Swine and did therefore commit an offense under the Animal Care Act, and the judge gave me the maximum fine of $5,000. The codes of practice are fully enforceable in Manitoba, and we have no problem enforcing them.
If that was extended to the rest of the country, I mean, do you feel that producers would see this as a positive development?
I would hope so. What I tell my, like, when we prosecute people, I write 25 charges. Because when the prosecutor gets a negotiation, he stays half of them. That's just, it's the etiquette of prosecution. So what I tell my prosecutor, if I have a offense that I wrote under the code of practice and a very similar offense under a regulation, stay the charge under the regulation. Because the charge under the code of practice is what this guy's peers said he should do, not what some bureaucrat writing my act in downtown Winnipeg said he should do. So the offense under the code of practice, and the code of practices are 100% common sense. There is nothing stupid in the code of practice. So if you violate a code of practice standard and animals are injured, that's the one I want prosecuted. I want more convictions. And in this swine case, I had 14 convictions. Seven were under the act and regulations, and seven were under the swine code of practice. The code of practices are a wonderful tool to discourage bad behavior, even though they were written to encourage good behavior. Yeah. If you construct your enforcement and compliance system correctly, you can also use the codes of practice to discourage bad behavior. And the people that I prosecute that are livestock producers, they are an embarrassment to their profession. They are an embarrassment to other livestock producers, and the people most injured by their bad behavior, in addition to the big pile of dead animals, are the livestock producers that they pretend they are, is the commodity that they happen to be participating in. That commodity is injured whenever I have to prosecute a livestock situation.
Neil Jotham. How's that? Okay, good. I don't know whether this question is directed to any one of you, and it may well be a better question at the very end, but there, thank you. Through the whole meeting, there's been an obvious need to continue animal welfare-oriented research. So I'm wondering whether there's any kind of commitment for 50% partners of industry and government to maintain this need.
Okay, so if I understand the question is the industry investment in animal welfare research. I think in Canada we're extremely lucky to have a great deal of investment from the industries, and most of our funding for animal welfare research does come from industry matched by either provincial or federal funds. There's a number of opportunities for that, and I am very pleased with my current position now is a large investment from Ag Farmers of Canada as a research chair in poultry welfare to help lead the industry now with the science when they're facing a number of challenges concerning animal welfare of laying hens. So I think most of us in the research community here would say that we're we have a good opportunity to work both getting the research support, financial support, as well as opportunities to work on, in commercial situations. And I hope that continues and continues to grow, because I think that's where a lot of advances, real advances in animal welfare, are going to be on farms.
Yes, I'd like to comment on behalf of the producer organization, Sue. We agree. We need research before we can make, assumptions don't work. You mentioned earlier the surprising results of some of the, long-distance transportation or in the results of the transportation. And we conducted some of that research for beef cattle as well and found it was very positive. And a lot of the assumptions out there that were just that. They were assumptions. So research to both to improve but also to verify what we're doing is, very important.
With the pork industry, I just want to say to Terry Whiting, thank you very much for that last response. You're right on. Thank you.
I think I just want to make a comment as well on the whole research aspect. I just want to echo what Tina was saying. The support of the industry is just absolutely amazing. Without them, there'd be very little opportunity for animal welfare research being done. You've heard a lot in this meeting about the dairy cluster projects and the money being coming from Dairy Farmers of Canada for that. Within Alberta, we have a fantastic relationship with Alberta Milk and funding from them in terms of some of the research we're doing at Calgary. Much of the research that my PhD students working on in beef transport relies completely on a relationship with industry in order to look at transporting of animals and animals at the Cargill plant. So I think the industry is providing great leadership in the area of animal welfare research. And most of the structures that are in place now in terms of funding is requiring more and more partnering, which is actually putting a great deal more pressures on industry to come up with those funds.
Hi, Crystal Mackay, Ontario Farm Animal Council. This one's for Penny. And Penny and I, and many of the people in this room, have worked a long time on trying to encourage the continual advancement, improvement of animal welfare. And no one works harder than Penny at trying to actually get people to implement new practices and new ideas. So we've got, kind of research world here and then communications world, writing fact sheets and training programs and videos. Any insights or challenges, barriers on how to actually get people to change practices or attitudes or a wish list maybe you have to give some of the people in this room direction on actually how to make people that really work with animals do a better job?
Yeah, as I said, Crystal, that, it's really the opportunity for, one-on-one exchanging, like the training we did a couple years ago with we had a training here in Guelph with Temple Grandin with people that work in a slaughter plant. They have a big meeting in the U.S. every year, American Meat Institute in Kansas City, and it's just all people from the industry, and they get together and they share ideas, and it's almost like a religious experience, but it's really good. And I've tried to convince them to have it in Winnipeg. No offense, Terry. In Winnipeg in February, because I thought Kansas City, Winnipeg, about the same. So we had the training, and we had with Temple, and I don't even know when that was. I'm not good with time, but and we had to force the plant operators and people that work in the plants to come to the training. And we only made it a half a day, and we gave them lots of food and everything, and they came, and they're like on the comment cards, the assessment of the program, they're like, why wasn't it all day? Like, why can't, why do you have more of these or whatever? So that's the thing, is having, having the opportunity for people to access training. I mean, it's just not, we don't do that. We have seminars on, topics and new topics or whatever, but kind of the basics of, humane slaughter, humane transport, basics of farming, they're just not really that opportunity unless you want to sign up for 4 years at university or something. So that would be just making those things more readily available. Some things on the internet are fine, but I still think the sharing of ideas and what things work, and you can cut a lot of corners that way if somebody's already tried something. So that would be my wish list.
just like to probably just share with the group a little bit in terms of, we mentioned the benchmarking project that's going on with the Dairy Farmers of Canada in terms of looking at attitudes of producers' compliance with the codes. But one of the other aspects of that is to try to identify outreach approaches, materials that would be more effective to get co-compliance and knowledge about codes and adoption of things like codes. And we're running the first year with the dairy farmers because their codes are in place. But starting next fall, I'm looking for a PhD student to work for a three-year program to look specifically on extension and outreach programs to improve the compliance, the transfer of this information on animal welfare and codes to different commodity organizations. That's being funded by NFAC.
Hi, David Truss. I mentioned my name in part to emphasize the overrepresentation of Davids here, which is very good to see. I grew up in an Italian neighborhood, and Luigi Giuseppe was a more ordinary name. Ed, you mentioned about financial incentives, and in order to continue driving animal welfare, right now we've got a good push and some government money in. This is not to say because we're not going to provide support in the future, but you know, and Susie Miller's message too was that there will be constraints on governments too. So the cost of doing a good job sometimes has to be funded. And one of the things I often mention is that financial incentives can be a real pull, but where do you see the financial incentives coming from? Normally, producers see only costs. They don't see the real benefits, although it can accrue to their overall production in the longer term. But on the consumer side, and I often use the example of you see people waddling out of a Walmart with the huge piles, because the lowest price is the law. Animal welfare is not the law. The lowest price is the law. So the market signal is not working between the consumer and the producer. How do we make that work better?
Yeah, we often talk about the consumer and the producer. The link between consumer and producer is really very weak. And I think if you're looking at that relationship as a way of funding or where the incentives come from, I think it's a pretty long way to get from point A to point B. There's an awful lot of middlemen to go through and people taking pieces of the pie as you go through. And so when I lived in Indiana, I could buy a dozen eggs for 99 cents, and right beside it were the labeled ones for $3.99. That didn't reflect cost of production at all, but none of that extra dollars, none of that extra money was really going to the producers. And so I think we have to look at the entire chain rather than just expecting that it's going to go from producer to consumer. There's an awful lot of other people taking pieces of that money, and there should be places where there's incentives and possibilities to do that.
I'd never miss the opportunity to slag the federal government if I possibly could. So, David, one of the weaknesses I think that we have in Canada is that the federal government represents producers. It represents consumers, and it represents non-consumers. So one of the problems we have in a national animal welfare system is I believe we have inadequate participation of the federal government in the representation of non-consumers. So should we be embarrassed that NFAC has such a difficult time funding itself, and it's really funded by project grants, and it comes from the federal government, but the federal government is not signaling to Canadians that animal welfare is a public good, farm animal welfare is a public good, and that the federal government is going to participate in long-term farm animal welfare initiatives because it's in the public interest to do so. So I think Australia might have a little bit of a step up on us in that I think that's... Where's the woman from Australia? Is she here?
Kathleen?
Look, I think that national signal has been made in Australia that the federal government or the Commonwealth, whatever you call it, that they have recognized that farm animal welfare is good for consumers, good for producers, good for animals, but it's good for citizens. And what we don't have in Canada is we don't have a strong citizen representative on the animal welfare debate. Like the Canadian Federation of Humane Societies is strapped to participate in the National Farm Animal Code committees because of lack of funding. And that's a, I think that's a systematic problem that we have to correct in the next 10 years or 5 years, or maybe you can do it tomorrow because you're God Almighty.
Ron Maynard with Dairy Farms. I guess think Dave took part of my question. You know, I see there being two types of marketing in Canada. One is supply management, and you know we are limited by we have no exports coming in and can so control the market. Those people in the other red meat, the cattlemen and our pork people that have to compete with imports that don't have the same standards as we do. So how do you live with that problem? And how do you, you know, the speaker from Australia said, you know, are those imports, I noticed from her slide, the imports were a major part of the domestic consumption. Are those imports labeled correctly as far as animal care of those imports? So just some comments, if you might, on that concern. Thank you.
Do you want to go first?
Well, I guess it's an issue that's raising its head in terms of development of, you know, trade agreements. There's an agreement right now of kind of a free trade agreement in place that's being developed between the EU and a number of South American countries in terms of import of beef, and the countries in Europe are extremely terrified of Brazilian meat coming in and at a very cheap price, and they're not sure if they're going to be able to stop it from occurring. But the tack that they've taken is to try to put forward the fact that the standards are different, and that the animal welfare standards specifically are different, and therefore shouldn't allow that product into the EU. It becomes a problem under. It's also happening in the British meat markets and swine markets, in terms of the British farmers really being worried about that and looking at their animal welfare standards. The problem, from a trade perspective, as I understand it, is that it's not possible really to put up barriers based on how product is actually being produced in the different countries. The comparison is a comparison based on like product, not production methods. So I'm not sure I'm answering your question. I'm just sharing some comments that animal welfare standards are being used, not officially as trade barriers, but unofficially as ways of trying to create trade barriers.
Yeah, I think it's so important to get our code of practice right. And so far, there's nothing in the proposed beef code of practice that I see that will put us in a competitive disadvantage. I actually see the opposite. Most of these recommendations come from things that result in a more profitable and sustainable operations. For instance, like providing clean water, that's sort of new as a requirement. The industry has done it on their own. We're using solar and wind and you know dams and things like that, taking the animals out of the streams and ponds, and finding that it actually, you know, has been favorable to the bottom line because the cattle do better. So, you know, unless we have to make sure that the code of practice is not just what people assume should be done. You know, we have to research it, and we have to make sure not only that it's, you know, profitable, but or better for the animal, but it has to be something that will be acceptable by the producers.
Hi, my name's Leanne Cooley. I work with LH Gray & Son, Gray Ridge Eggs in Ontario. And to Dr. Pijor, I was really excited to hear about your quest for a graduate student here, for someone to look at motivations or motivation behind extension work and how do we get knowledge transfer out there. It's a big personal area of interest of mine and something that I struggle with on a day-to-day basis because I work a lot with producers and industry. My experience has been a little bit that motivations between some of the different producer groups, and there's a difference even between supply managed versus non-supply managed commodities about their willingness to come to these types of informational sessions and knowledge transfer and how open they are to making that investment. Is your, specifically to what your focus is going to be on, is it one specific commodity, or are you looking towards trying to look at extension work and knowledge transfer amongst agriculture as a whole, or sort of within a specific commodity group?
I guess the idea is that with something like a project like that, you hope to address some really basic principles and concepts and understand those better in terms of what works. We will probably test it with a specific commodity group in mind, but with the idea of developing or understanding the underlying principles. There's been some work done on this already in European countries and things like that, and it's a problem that many organizations have. People who are developing problems or developing programs, trying to get them out to the industry, whatever industry it is. But there seems to be, you know, some kind of grouping of producers that you could actually find within most commodity groups, and that, you know, you have early adopters, you know, the wait and seers. You know, there's a whole list of categories you can come up with. I think the message is going to be that the first step is going to be understanding who's in your commodity group. What type of producers do you have? Do you have an organization that is made up of 20% of early adopters? They go to a meeting, they see a good idea, and boom, all of a sudden it's gone, and they're using it, right? At that point, you can ask the question, well, how successful is my extension program being? I only have 25% of my industry adopting this thing within 6 months. Well, in fact, if you've got really only 20% that are early adopters and you've actually managed to hit 25, you're doing a great job. Right? And these different types of producers, different types of individuals will all have kind of different ways of taking in information and all that type of stuff. So you may have to develop kind of a strategy of outreach, which isn't we can do everything in 6 months and expect stuff to happen, because you know what? We've got 80% of our group that are wait and seers. We have to come back to them with success stories 2 to 3 years from now in order to show them and convince them that the program we introduced, you know, 3 years earlier is actually effective, and maybe then we can get them on board, and maybe that's a successful outreach strategy. Does that help?
Yeah. Florian Posberg here, hog producer. One of the things that producers tell me, and I think fear, is that we will develop codes in our industry. Gestation stalls are kind of at the top of the list, and some of their concerns include, well, quite frankly, if we make compromises on gestation stalls, does that satisfy the public, or is that just the next step to the next issue? I guess my question is twofold, and to all the panel. What's our Achilles heels in our agriculture industry after the current ones are dealt with, and are we correct in assuming that the tension between the general public and our animal production by nature just will always be questioned?
To start, I
okay, Achilles heels. I think after restriction of behavior, which is a issue that the swine industry is facing with stalls, and the egg industry is facing with cages. Okay. After that, I think probably painful procedures would be next on the list. That's where we're seeing the attention, or painful procedures being done without anesthetic and analgesic. Okay. And we know there's a lot of research directed in that area. And then after that may be production-related problems, for this, which is something that's very difficult for producers themselves to control, but rather the selection for high rates of productivity causing basically an unhealthy animal in other ways. That would be my list. Ed?
Yeah, I think I probably echo that. I think if you think back to those three circles of overlap that Jeff showed, and I do think that what we're talking about is we're talking about things outside of production, outside of health issues. We're talking about things like the feelings and mental states of animals and whether or not they can perform normal behavior. That's where the restriction of the behavior comes in. That's where I don't think it's painful procedures as much as the lack of pain mitigation. Mm-hmm. I think people can accept the fact that sometimes things have to happen and that there's procedures that need to be done, but why in today's days and age we can't do something about pain mitigation when they take their dog to the veterinarian, the same procedure is done and it has pain mitigation and it's not a question. So I think those are probably, I think I would probably echo Tina. I think things where you're exposed to the public in terms of transportation issues is a big one as well. But for the same reason, are those animals cold? Are they frozen? Are they hot? And those types of things. What's the animals actually experiencing? So I think it's those types of issues. That being said, I don't think anybody in the public is going to accept animals being sick and being put into their food supply chain either. So it's kind of don't stop doing the good stuff we've been doing, but I really want you to start thinking about the whole mental states and feelings and behaviors of those animals.
Hi, Ashley Gaudet. I'm here representing Feedlot Health Management Services. My question is for Dr. Whiting. I'm just wondering if the Office of the Chief Provincial Officer has a website identifying a list of the reportable welfare infractions, or can you provide a list or some examples of some?
That's really a difficult thing to do. In Manitoba, the Act is published on web. The Act is freely open to everybody. Freely available. Regulations are freely available. We publish quarterly statistics on complaints and open cases. We have a list of offenses that are ticketable that you can prosecute by a common offense notice, which is the same way the RCMP prosecute for Highway Traffic Act violations. So all those things are sort of available. Most of our responses from the public are, my name is so-and-so, and I'm concerned about this thing. That's the way the story goes. So they tell us where it is, and then we go look at it. I mean, that's really the way it works.
But as a veterinarian, like going to
a client? Like... Oh, the other thing in Manitoba is that we have, we require veterinarians to report suspected animal neglect under our Act, and if they do so in good faith, they're protected from civil liability. We actually require veterinarians to report, and we have kind of a tricky regulation with livestock assembly yards, in that we went to our constitutional lawyer about this, and it's in the provincial jurisdiction to regulate business management practices. Any business management practice is provincial jurisdiction. So we wrote a two-part regulation saying that it was illegal or it was an offense under the Animal Care Act for a livestock assembly yard to accept an animal for further sale that was unfit to transport. So that was regulating the business practice. And then there's a second part of the regulation is that once they make that business decision, then they're compelled to report it to the chief veterinary officer. So that's how we dealt with our, and that change of the act just came in about 6 months ago. So now we're looking at, we're working with our Auction Market Association to say, well, now that we have this on the regulatory books, there are public citizen interests that are going to hold us accountable. We have to develop an inspection form, a schedule for inspecting auction markets, and they expect our activities to be reported in the annual. We publish a Manitoba Agriculture annual report that's free on the internet. People, concerned Canadian citizens, are going to say, well, you got this power, what are you doing with it? So it's going to be a whole new area for us to regulate, because we've dealt with complaints from auction markets, you know, but we've never coerced auction market management into being partners in animal welfare assurance. And that's really what we've done, is we've coerced the auction market managers to be extension for us, we got some pushback from the cattle industry, you know, for fairly strong, but we got an NDP government. They overruled them. So I just work for the government, okay?
Can I have a quick comment on that? I mentioned earlier that I feel the market will, you know, do a lot of the enforcement for us as well. And a couple of examples, the large processing plant that I deliver to in southern Alberta, I actually have my own cattle liner and haul in there myself, so I'm familiar with the issues that the truckers face. There was a lot of truckers. The triaxle trailers are designed for about 65,000 pounds. But a lot of them that were coming in, if they knew they didn't have to pass a Department of Transportation scale or whatever, they would take a chance and load an extra 3,000 or 4,000. There were loads coming in approaching 70,000 pounds. And the plant took it on their own. Like outside of waiting for the highway department to find these guys, they started blacklisting their trailers. They gave them one chance, or their truckers. They gave them one chance for, you know, an honest mistake. But if they come in a second time, they're not allowed back in the plant for a month. And, I mean, just as soon as they put that in, it came to a stop. The word got around, and they're not going to do it. Another one is what you mentioned, Terry, shipping animals unfit for transport. That same operation put a $300 per head fine or penalty on animals that were condemned for health reasons. And so that took that element, we had unscrupulous producers that would possibly ship an animal with the chance that she would bring a few hundred, the $400 I heard somebody say earlier. You know, they're not only have that risk of not getting paid for, but they also are subject to a fine. And it's those kind of things are coming from the market.
Thanks very much. And thank you. Let's give a good thanks to this great panel. Thank you.